Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
I'm Roland Pease, and in Discovery Today, I'm going to look at the contribution to today's world of one of the most remarkable mathematicians of the 20th century, born in June 1912.
He was a genius, absolutely no question about it. To have this idea of a universal computer was quite remarkable. And to write out a complete description of an electronic computer when there wasn't such a thing, that was quite something too.
That genius was Alan Turing, and as you'd have heard in last week's programme, still available on the BBC website, in his early 20s as a newly elected fellow of King's College Cambridge, Turing conceived a hypothetical paper and pencil computer that could do anything a mathematician could do. 10 years later, after a heroic spell breaking German secret codes, he arrived at the National Physical Laboratory to turn that conceptual machine into hardware. The kind of circuitry needed for Turing's automatic computing engine already existed in the secret Colossus code cruncher that had been built during World War II and which Alan Turing knew all about. But Turing's universal computer needed a memory as well to make it different from that giant electronic calculator. The memory where all the instructions and all the data were to be stored so that the machine could be turned from one problem to another with no internal rewiring.
Well, I don't know that I can pick that up. It's extraordinarily heavy. This is a Mercury delay line, and it was the basis of the memory in the ACE.
Today, we hardly notice the silicon flash drives on which we carry around gigabytes of data. But this clunky metal pole, looking a bit like a weightlifter's dumbbells, was revolutionary in the 1940s. Straining to hold it up, Turing biographer Jack Copeland told me why.
It's essentially a metal pipe. It's about 5 feet long, full of mercury, which is why it's so heavy. And it stored pulses of sound. There were beeps going down this tube. And that was the first computer memory. The bits, the zeros and ones, were stored in the memory as pulses of sound. Turing was very excited in 1945 because he thought that they were in the game with this new device. It was going to solve the computer memory problem.
If only it were that simple. The delay lines had proved themselves during the war, cleaning up the signals in radar sets. But converting these poles into memory devices was quite a different challenge. And at the National Physical Laboratory, where Turing was working, they had none of the technical facilities to develop them. The work was contracted out, but progress was slow, and the NPL management, well, at best it was ineffective. Frustration built up for those involved, particularly for Turing, who'd been used to seeing things happen on demand during his code-breaking days. And with frustration came tension, says Mike Woodger, one of his key colleagues on the project recently recorded for the NPL.
He didn't get on well with the director. He wanted to do things himself with his own soldering arm. "Oh, no," said the director. "We ask officers like you to produce the ideas. We have contractors to do the constructing." Turing was absolutely livid at that.
Turing might well have been too far ahead of the people who were building it.
And this is another of Turing's colleagues from the time, Tom Vickers.
But lots of effort was made in getting something built by cooperation with others, and others were a bit reluctant to cooperate. So progress was disappointing. We could see progress being made in Cambridge and in Manchester, where they'd organised themselves much better than NPL could.
Turing took time out, returning for a year to King's College, Cambridge, where he was still a fellow in maths. But he was barely on speaking terms with Maurice Wilkes, who was heading the computer constructors there. And meanwhile, engineers at Manchester University were rushing ahead with a completely different approach to the memory problem. The so-called Manchester baby computer was lovingly rebuilt in the 1990s by enthusiasts who wanted the world to see one of the iconic machines in computing history. It's now in the Manchester Museum of Science and Industry, which is where I met Turing's last student, Bernard Richards, and Chris Burton, leader of the rebuild, and full of admiration for the get-go of the team who built the original.
Bear in mind, it was immediately after the war, and the three principal engineers had come from telecommunications research establishment in Malvern, where they'd been the experts on circuit techniques for radar. So they knew the component and knew everything they wanted. And Freddie Williams, having left TRE, been recruited to be Professor of Electrotechnics here at the university, when he left, did a good deal, and he had free access to the stores at Malvern. So things like this metalwork, these would be standard parts used at Malvern for doing experimental electronic work, radar and so on. So it was very much a sort of do-it-yourself as you go along sort of job.
Remind us, Chris, the time from beginning to end.
They brought up some equipment from Malvern in January 1947. They'd already started on the memory system, and they were able to store one binary digit at that point. So they came with a bunch of equipment, and essentially Tom Kilburn was working full-time on it. Freddie Williams was trying to run the department in parallel. And by October of 47, that's within 9 months, they were storing 2,000 digits. So they were, during that 9 months, they were building it up.
Professor Freddie Williams and his assistant Tom Kilburn completely avoided the mercury delay lines that had given Turing so much trouble with his memory. Theirs used cathode ray tubes, the little TV-like screens you see in old war movies, with blinking green radar blips showing the approach of an enemy aircraft. Williams and Kilburn had come from radar research and realised that the dots of static electricity left on the phosphorescent screens could be used as electronic memory. In a way, by starting with the memory, they came to the whole computer problem from the far end.
Our primary objective was to make a computing machine, because a store, as a store, is a useless object. It has to be used for something. The question of whether it is suitable for use in a computing machine can only be established in one way, and that is by using it in a computing machine. So as soon as we got the cathode ray tube stores working something like reasonably, we switched our effort to building what we called our baby computer.
This is Freddie Williams himself, leader of the Manchester team and recorded by the London Science Museum in 1975.
Now, let's be clear before we go any further that neither Tom Kilburn nor I knew the first thing about computers. Now, very fortunate in this respect, because we had in the university here Professor Newman, and Newman explained the whole business of how a computer works to us. It took him, I think, all of half an hour. So we went away and decided to build one.
The arrival in this story of Max Newman is no accident. It was Max Newman's lectures in Cambridge in 1935 that had first set Alan Turing off on his quest for his notional mathematical universal computing device. And it was to Newman that he first showed his seminal paper. What's more, Max Newman had run the suite of Colossus electronic code crunchers at Bletchley Park. Turing biographer Jack Copeland thinks that Freddie Williams' dismissive
took him, I think, all of half an hour
betrays underlying tensions between the engineers, Williams and Kilburn, and their mathematical neighbours at Manchester.
Tom Kilburn himself, there was a terrible personality thing between him and Turing, and Tom Kilburn, even through gritted teeth, he wouldn't give credit to Turing. And if you asked him, well, Tom, where did you actually get the idea of a computer from? He'd say something like, somehow I got the idea of a stored program computer, but I really can't remember how I got the idea. But actually, there's no mystery about where he got the idea from. He went to Turing's lectures. Williams sent him off to Turing's lectures. Kilburn sat there. He was a very good pupil. And he very quickly went from a position of almost total ignorance to being able to design a stored program computer of his own. He was a brilliant engineer, of course. He'd worked with Williams on radar during the war. Between the two of them, there wasn't much about electronic engineering that they didn't know. You know, they were the two guys to build the first computer. There's no doubt about that. They were both brilliant engineers.
They also had the guile to try walking before they ran. At the National Physical Laboratory, Turing had launched himself into designing a computer that could do all the things he had foreseen in his mathematical imagination and was eager to see in progress. It was way beyond anyone's engineering skill. At Manchester, Williams and Kilburn knew that what they needed was just the simplest machine to prove the principle of a universal computer. With the hardware in place, the next step was to write a program to run on it. Tom Kilburn.
That program had no mathematical significance. I chose a very simple mathematical operation, which is to find the highest factor of a number. That is because that with that program I could use all the instructions which we'd built into the machine, and so it was demonstrating that the memory which we'd invented worked and the computer worked.
The 21st of June 1948 was a key moment in the history of computers. The first time an, albeit simple, program had been run on a computer, the granddaddy of all the computers we use today. And it fulfilled all the criteria Turing had set out in his 1936 paper for a universal machine. Meanwhile, his former colleagues at the National Physical Laboratory had managed to get the gears of management to support their project properly. And 2 years after the baby had launched the computer age, their stripped-down pilot Model Ace spluttered into action, with a counting program designed to light a series of light bulbs. Jim Wilkinson, Turing's erstwhile right-hand man, later recalled the Ace's first stumbling steps in this Science Museum recording.
The delay line was not very good, and it took rather a long time to put even these six or seven instructions in. It was one evening, rather late, Orway and I were the only ones left there. We kept putting this program in, and it kept on forgetting before we could get it in. But then finally, the lights all came up, you see, and so we realized that it was working. And so we went away. Unfortunately, we were the only two there by that time. And when we came in the next morning, it didn't work, and it didn't work again for about another 3 days.
On the other hand, the pilot ace, when completed and programmed according to instructions laid down years earlier by Alan Turing, was phenomenally efficient, says Turing biographer Jack Copeland.
Once it fired up, the pilot Model Ace, although it wasn't the first, his machine was faster than any of them. It actually blew them off the stage. It just left them in the dust.
By now, Alan Turing was with his old friend Max Newman in Manchester. But he was already thinking well beyond worrying about the design and operation of computers. He was interested in how far they could be pushed. Even in 1946, while he was working on the ACE, he told a friend that computing was about far more than just maths.
In working on the ACE, I am more interested in the possibility of producing models of the action of the brain than in the practical applications to computing.
Turing's work in machine thinking was barely noticed then. Now he's seen as one of the main begetters of artificial intelligence. But one project at the frontier wasn't enough for this mathematician at the height of his powers. For the next, he needed help.
I was actually number two, his second student, and unfortunately, because he died before I finished, I was his second and last student.
This is Bernard Richards, whose task was to work on morphogenesis, the mathematical theory of the growth of living forms, another of the new paths his inventive mentor was heading down. In his few months with Turing, Bernard Richards had little chance to get to know his tutor well, but Turing did very quickly make a truly lasting impression.
He was a very kind man. I would compare Alan Turing to a boiled sweet. He was very hard on the outside and tender and sweet inside. But when I used the word hard, I didn't mean cruel. I meant he wasn't sloppy and affectionate. He was rigorous and consistent too, and that made one want to look up to him as one did.
He was so gentle. He was a very private man and I was very shy. Turned out, although he had all this experience, he was a very shy man too.
Mike Woodger also remembers Turing's gentle nature from his ACE days at the National Physical Laboratory. For example, his simple gestures to make life easier for his colleagues.
In fact, the other day I came across a letter I thought I'd lost. See, when I joined in 1946, most of the August, I was away, sick, because I had picked up glandular fever. Anyway, the time came, and both Wilkinson and Turing were away. Turing realised that I was going to come back and there'd be nobody to supervise me, you see. Well, being the man he was, he wrote an absolutely charming letter, apologising for not being there, and a list of things I might do. And knowing that I was probably feeling a bit weak with glandular fever, he said, you know, read a book. Or this and this, various kind suggestions.
In 1952, 2 years before he died, Alan Turing was convicted under England's old laws outlawing homosexuality. He was forced to take female hormones, a form of chemical castration, as a condition for avoiding prison. When he died, the coroner said he took his life deliberately while the balance of his mind was disturbed. The picture has developed of a quiet, tragic hero emotionally wasted in his final 2 years. A picture biographer Jack Copeland suspects is quite wrong.
In 1954, his career was at a high point. When he died, there were many pages of notes, typewritten notes, that he left behind, which would no doubt have formed the basis of future papers.
But there was nothing externally that anyone had any idea how his other life was turning, that his work, what they were seeing at Manchester University, there was no hint of the turmoil in his life.
Well, you say turmoil. What evidence is there that there was turmoil in his life?
Jack Copeland now argues that the coroner was rash and that Turing's death might equally have been a chemical accident, resulting from his careless experiments with cyanide in a home-built lab next to his bedroom. But that doesn't change the tragedy of an extraordinary life cut horribly short. What's more, at the time, most of the world barely noticed his passing. A humbling thought to end this two-part BBC Discovery series on one of Britain's most remarkable mathematicians.
I don't think much attention was paid to his death. It wasn't that there were headlines saying national treasure dies at the age of only 41. Nobody really knew what he'd done. In terms of war heroes, who do you think of? Churchill, Eisenhower. And then it's got to be Turing. You know, his breakthroughs were absolutely crucial in the Battle of the Atlantic. But nobody knew that. And then there was this whole other side of his life. He also invented the store program computer. But again, nobody really knew this. So no one really appreciated the significance of Turing in the history of computing. So he was a national hero on two fronts. If people had known what Turing had done during the war, when he died, there'd have been a state funeral. But there was just nothing. No one knew. He was an insignificant figure, this strange, eccentric doctor who died in Manchester, and he had something to do with this funny thing called an electronic brain. It was of really no national interest whatsoever. Should have been.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.